You've been searching for the best way to generate passive income in your life and heard that real estate is a great way to do it. But you're tired of all the so-called gurus who are all talk and no substance. Get ready to celebrate because Kevin Buck has spent 14 years successfully making it happen. This is the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Now, here's Kevin Buck.
Hey guys, Kevin Bupp here with episode number 138 of the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast, where our mission is to help you build and maintain massive amounts of cash flow through income-producing real estate investments. And our guest for this week's show is passive commercial real estate investment expert Jeremy Roll. Jeremy has been an active real estate and business investor for more than 15 years. He left the corporate gig back in 2007 to become a full passive cash flow investor. He is currently invested in more than 70 different opportunities across $500 million worth of real estate and business assets. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Jeremy in person a few weeks back in Denver at a real estate conference where we were both speaking. And I have to say that this man is absolutely brilliant and is someone that you need to be listening to. He is 100% data-driven when it comes to his investing style, which has proved very successful over his 15-year stint of being a passive real estate investor. And in this interview with Jeremy, you're going to learn the following. You'll learn why he prefers passive investments versus being the lead sponsor in a deal. You'll learn Jeremy's definition of diversification and what that means to a passive investor. You'll learn why he prefers operators who focus on no more than two asset types at any given time. You're going to get Jeremy's advice on becoming an expert in a particular asset class prior to becoming a passive investor. He's going to teach you the best methods for seeking out the various private offerings available to passive investors. And he's also going to show you how to properly vet the sponsors of an opportunity. So if you're looking at getting involved in a syndication, he's going to talk to you about how to properly vet the sponsors to make sure you're getting teamed up with a good set of operators. He's going to discuss what circumstances would cause a yellow flag versus a red flag when considering opportunities to invest in. You'll learn why he loves mobile home parks and self-storage facilities during both the good times as well as the bad parts of a real estate cycle. And you're going to learn why you should be cautious if you're buying in today's market and much, much more. And if this is the first time you're tuning in the show, I want to welcome you to our incredible family that we have here at the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. Or if you're one of the many thousands of loyal listeners who make listening to our show a part of their weekly ritual, I want to welcome you back and just thank you all from the bottom of my heart for being a part of our incredible community that we have here at the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. This is an awesome job that I have, and I wouldn't have it if it wasn't for you. So thank you so, so much. And if you do love what we're doing here, then I kindly ask that you take a minute and head over to iTunes to leave us a 5-star rating and review. The reviews that you leave, they really help us grow the show, helps us attract awesome guests like Jeremy to come and join us, okay? So if you haven't done so already, just take a minute. It's really quick to do. Go over to iTunes, leave a review and rating, and I would greatly appreciate it. And just a few laundry list items before we get onto the show with Jeremy. The first one is I want to remind you about the free 30-minute phone consultation that I offer to all of our listeners here. This is something I've been doing now for a couple of years. This is where you and I can get on the phone together for 30 minutes. No ulterior motives. I won't give you any kind of sales pitch. I won't try to push you into a coaching program or anything like that. This is just a way for me to connect with the listeners and help you if needed, or just talk shop. You know, we can literally do anything that your heart desires on that phone call regarding real estate investing. So if you're just getting started, maybe you're already a seasoned investor, you know, we can talk about whatever your heart desires. Again, as long as it pertains to real estate investing during those 30 minutes. So to schedule that call with me, go to my website, kevinbupp.com. On the right-hand side, scroll about 3/4 of the way down, and there's a button that says schedule a call with Kevin. Click on that, and it'll take you to my calendar link. Pick a time that works best for you. And all I do ask is that you actually put some details in the notes section about what you'd like to chat about during our 30 minutes together, and I'll look forward to catching up with you, okay? Next laundry list item is the Academy, the Mobile Home Park Academy. It's finally here. Yeah, seriously, you heard me correctly. I know I've been talking about this thing for like a year and a half now. But it's here, guys, the long-awaited Mobile Home Park Academy. It's now live, and it's open for business. My business partner, Charles Dehart, and myself, we've been working our butts off for the past year and a half putting together this program, and can confidently say that it's hands down the most comprehensive training on mobile home park investing that you'll ever find. Charles and I, we've been through every different boot camp, every book. We attended at, you know, industry roundtables, masterminds, and I can confidently say that this program that we put together is it just blows them all away, okay? And so if you have any interest whatsoever about investing in mobile home parks, you know that's what I do. You know, that's what my preferred investment type is. I mean, I've invested in tons of single family homes, lots of apartment buildings. I've owned office buildings. I mean, I've done a little bit of everything, and I love mobile home parks. I mean, the returns are superior. The ease of management is superior to a lot of other asset types. And so if you have any interest whatsoever in investing in mobile home parks, then you got to check this out. In fact, Charles and I actually put together a 2-hour free training, a very in-depth. So it's not just a sales pitch or anything like that, but we put together a very in-depth 2-hour free training that we offer on our website, mobilehomeparkacademy.com. You can actually check out the web class, learn about how we do market analysis, how we actually build database of targeted owners that we market to buy these parks that we own in our portfolio. We give that all away for free, and it's a 2-hour class. Obviously, at the end of that class, we'll talk to you about the academy, but this isn't a sales pitch here. This is seriously, this is a very unique training that we put together, and we did it because we wanted to give people kind of a taste of what it is that we do, and also what they could expect from the full-blown academy. So again, if you have any interest whatsoever and investing in mobile home parks, or even just learning about the asset type, if you just have any interest whatsoever, go watch that web class. It's free. It's on our website, mobilehomeparkacademy.com. You can register for it and check it out. If you have an interest, I think a lot of your questions will be answered. If you have more questions, you can reach out to me directly, okay? I'd love to talk to you about the asset type. I love it. I don't think I'll make a change anytime soon. We plan to be investing in mobile home parks for at least the next 10 or 15 years. So anyway, go check it out. Again, mobilehomeparkacademy.com. And just a couple more laundry list items real quick here is we also have a mobile home park podcast. It's Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. You can find it on iTunes. You can also listen to the previous episodes on the Mobile Home Park Academy website. And whether or not you have an interest in mobile home parks, I can tell you that you can learn a ton from that show. I mean, everything that we talk about is applicable to every other type of asset that you could potentially invest in. So again, it's a very informative podcast. We do it weekly, and I think that you could get a ton of value, even if you're a single family home or a shopping center or an apartment investor, you can get a lot of value from that show. And one last thing I want to mention here is we have a bunch of partnership opportunities that we have rolling out here very soon. If you have any interest in partnering with my team and I on mobile home park investments, if you have any interest whatsoever, shoot us an email, partner@mobilehomeparkacademy.com. And on that email, you'll actually be sent a link to our calendar. And this is so that in case you have an interest in talking to with us directly, you can actually schedule a time and we'll get on the phone with you and talk to you about some of the partnership opportunities that we have available. So if you have any interest whatsoever in partnering with us on some future deals that we're doing, then shoot us an email, partner@mobilehomeparkacademy.com. And last but not least, guys, if you're in the Tampa Bay area, if you're visiting for work, for pleasure, whatever it might be, I'd love to meet with you. If you got some extra time, you want to get together, grab a coffee, grab a beer, lunch, whatever you have time for, whatever our schedules can work out, I'd love to meet with you. Shoot me an email. My personal email is kevin@kevinbub.com. That is my own personal email. Let me know when you're coming, and let's see if we can coordinate a time to get together. Okay, I love meeting others in this business that share a passion that I do. You have the same passion I do. So shoot me an email, kevin@kevinbub.com, and I will look forward to potentially meeting you here in Tampa Bay. So guys, now let's get on to the part of the show that you've been waiting for, which is our interview with Jeremy Rohl. So here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, today on the show, we are thrilled to be joined by real estate investment expert, Jeremy Rohl. Jeremy has been an active real estate and business investor for more than 15 years. He left the corporate world back in 2007 to become a full-time passive cash flow investor. He is currently an investor in more than 70 opportunities across $500 million worth of real estate and business assets. As founder and president of Rohl Investment Group, Jeremy manages a group of over 1,000 investors in the U.S. and Canada who seek passive and managed investments in real estate and businesses. Jeremy also co-founded Four Investors by Investors, a nonprofit organization in 2007 with a goal of networking with, learning from, and helping other investors. FIBI is now the largest group of public real estate investor meetings in California with over 23,000 members. Jeremy is originally from Montreal, is a licensed California real estate broker, has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business, and is an advisor for Realty Mogul, the largest real estate crowdfunding website in the U.S. Now, just in case you didn't know, we actually had Jeremy on the show way back on episode number 56. So, I mean, gosh, about 2 years ago or so. And on that show, we went in depth into Jeremy's unique business model, which is passively investing into a very large, diverse range of commercial real estate asset classes. And just in case you don't know what that means, unlike myself, who is actively running the daily operations of our real estate investments, Jeremy and his investment team are a lot of times the money behind these types of deals, these different syndications, okay? So they're typically the money, the passive guys behind the deals, and then guys like me are the ones that are running the front end show. So just in case you didn't know what that really meant there in terms of passive cash investing, but we'll dive a little deeper here today with Jeremy. And so I wanted to invite Jeremy back to the show because being that we only had an hour together in the last show, an hour goes by so fast when you're talking to someone as brilliant as Jeremy because he's just got a wealth of knowledge to share with us. So there was only so much that we could cover. And so I wanted to bring him back on and go a little bit more in depth on a few specific topics that we weren't able to cover last time. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Jeremy Roll back to the show. Jeremy, how you doing today, my friend?
I am good. Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, looking forward to catching back up. It's been a couple years now, many, many episodes ago. So, gosh, I can't even think back to episode 56 anymore. it's almost 100 episodes ago.
Yeah, congrats on your success with the podcast. I've listened to a lot of them. They're really great. I thank you for putting all the time into it, by the way. It's really great info.
Oh, I appreciate that, Jeremy. Well, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people like yourselves that are so brilliant and willing to share their wisdom with the rest of the world. So we appreciate you coming on. And, you know, for those that haven't had the chance to go back and listen to Jeremy or haven't heard you already, I mean, our show has grown by leaps and bounds since episode number 56. And so just for those that don't know who you are, Jeremy, maybe don't know a little bit of your background, maybe take a few minutes and just share a little bit about, you know, who you are and how you got into this business.
Sure. Yeah. Again, thanks for having me. So my story is probably going to sound familiar to some people out there. You know, I was in the corporate world and I was actually working at Disney headquarters back in 2002, which was 15 years ago now. And I had a great middle-level management job at Disney. And the dot-com crash that actually just happened, for those of you who are old enough to remember, that was back in 2001. And so the stock market just went up and went down tremendously in 2001. And so I'm sitting by my desk in 2002, and I was really sick and tired of the stock market for two reasons. One, which is a little more obvious, which is the volatility. In other words, you know, I'm a really low-risk, slow and steady guy. So to watch the market go up and down 30% a year just was not a good, you know, retirement investing strategy for me as long-term. But number two, which is actually bothering me even more, was frankly the lack of predictability. So not knowing where my retirement account would be in a day, a year, 10 years, 20 years, that was not a very good retirement strategy for me. I just wanted much more predictability. And so I started to look at different ways to invest outside of the typical stocks and bonds that most people look at and came across real estate and then more specifically cash flow. And so what occurred to me was that if I could find relatively low-risk opportunities that had cash flow associated with them and it was fairly predictable, then that would be a much better fit for me. And, you know, the best way to describe the kind of deal I'm talking about is, let's say a larger building, a 200-unit apartment building, or let's say you know, a 50 or 100-unit mobile home park where you're highly occupied. And, you know, for the apartment building example, just because I know a lot of people can relate to it, like let's say you find a 200-unit apartment building and it's 100% occupied. It's in a very high-demand area, and it's going to continue to be very highly occupied. You know, the idea and the way that I invest is that you kind of go to sleep tonight, wake up tomorrow, and not much has changed. That's truly the goal. And so, and the reason why I like that is because I live off the cash flow, right? So what I ended up doing was I ended up actually rotating all of my savings from stocks and bonds into cash flow. A lot of it was commercial real estate, not all of it was. And I invest always passively. I was way too busy in my job to do anything actively myself. So I was always a passive investor in syndications or managed opportunities. And so long story short is that I rotated all my money out of stocks and bonds into passive cash flow between 02 and 07. In mid-2007, I was actually working at Toyota headquarters in L.A. at the time, and I had a last straw moment in the corporate world. A new manager had come in, I was having challenges with them personally, and so I decided to leave the corporate world in mid-2007 because I had enough cash flow built up to live off of at that point. That wasn't the goal, actually. I didn't come into all this thinking I was going to leave the corporate world. I just like having the cash flow and, frankly, even kind of more predictable and in some ways better returns in the stock market than what I'm investing in. But I end up taking the risk, leaving the corporate world, living off the cash flow. And so my primary goal since 2007 has been to continue my cash flow stream and finding more and more opportunities to reinvest in so I never have to go back to the corporate world. And so, you know, I'm now 10 years into that. In fact, in June, it'll be my 10-year anniversary out of the corporate world. So I just talked to my wife the other day about maybe having some kind of party surrounding that.
So we need to get you a cake.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I've been investing in passive real estate opportunities for about 15 years now. And so that's my high-level background. I know you mentioned the introduction about foreign investors, buy investors, and I've been really lucky because a lot of what I've been able to accomplish has really been the product of networking, and that's really been the key. If, you know, anything I find in the way that these types of opportunities I invest in are typically privately marketed, so they're hard to find, and so it's kind of the product of many years of networking to be able to find good opportunities, good operators like you.
Talk to me a little bit about the decision you made. So, like, you, in 2007, you had enough cash flow built up from a passive standpoint, but you initially looked at the passive side of things because you just didn't have the time due to your corporate job, right? So, like, the corporate life just sucked too much of your time to where, like, your only option was to be passive. Was there ever a point in time where you started looking at potentially taking more of an active role since you were going to be leaving your corporate job? Or once you determined you're leaving your corporate job, did you ever look at maybe becoming a sponsor versus just being the passive guy?
Great question. So, you know, first of all, to be passive, you have to have the right type of personality. I talk to a lot of people. I'm always networking, talking to new people, new investors, sponsors, everybody else. And I will say that some people are only comfortable having full control and they want to be active. And so other people don't have the time and they're willing to be passive and give someone else control. And so the one thing I would actually say is that when you're trying to decide if you want to be active or passive, it's really about control. It's not just about work, but it's about control. So when I invest passively, I'm giving up control to somebody in exchange for diversification. And so, and we can get into a little bit more about that, but that's kind of the way that I look at it. I'm a huge fan of diversification. And so the idea of becoming a sponsor to me, you know, what happened is that I basically went down this passive path, got really diversified across the bit. And once I really saw the diversification, I loved that benefit of it. And so the best way to describe what happened to me is that I just liked the path I ended up going down. And so as of 2007, when I had more time, I could have possibly done more active stuff, but I just liked the passive path. It's definitely trickier being passive. You know, that there's more risk being passive in that you're giving up control. You're always going to have more risk when you give up control, such as fraud, mismanagement, other items that can come up. And so because of the additional risk that you incur as a passive investor, diversification is absolutely key. And to give you an idea, like right now, because it's been 15 years, I've invested in over 100 different LLCs over the time because it's been a long time. And I'm currently in over 70 different LLCs right now. And, you know, that level of diversification, it takes a long time to get there. But once you're there, you're in a really good place, hopefully, you know, if you've invested in, if you're focusing on lower risk stuff. And so I just continue to diversify further, and I just happen to like being on the passive side. And to be honest with you, I just love what I'm doing now. So I never really consider becoming active because that would disrupt the fact that I know I love what I'm doing now, taking the risk that I may not like it as much.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so talk to me a little bit, what does diversity mean to you? I mean, you know, in my mind, what comes to my mind, and maybe a lot of the listeners, is like, you know, different asset types, meaning like, you know, apartment buildings, shopping centers, office buildings, self-storage, mobile home parks. But it's a little more in depth than that. So give me, give us a more of a deeper definition of what diversification means to you and your business.
Yeah, and actually, I want to be clear, like, I'm not a financial advisor. If anything I say on this call, just my opinion as an investor, and definitely not, like, from a legal perspective, any advice to anybody, but because we can get into, like, more of a financial advisor diversification discussion. But for me, really what I kind of nailed it down to is diversification comes down to diversification across operators, geographies, and asset classes. That's kind of the three P's that I found for myself that I try to focus on. And so you want to get diversified across all three of those. And you obviously want to be diversified enough in terms of not too, putting too much of your money into one opportunity. But you also want to not put your, too much of your money into one operator, one geography, or one asset class. And that's how I handle my own diversification. I have a diversification discussion with a lot of different investors and just in my networking and stuff. And what I find is a lot of people tend to focus on, let's say, not putting more than X percent of their money into one deal. And, you know, it can range. You can see some people will say 2%, some people will say 5%, other people will say 10%, some I hear as high as 20, for example. And I, when I started off, I definitely was very cognizant of that, right, when you're first starting. But at a, when you get more highly diversified, it's better to, I think that you're going to switch and think of it more into that, you know, geography, operator, and asset class. So that's how I think of it.
Okay. So what are your thoughts on, I know that you deal with a lot of different operators, a lot of different asset classes. I mean, do you typically look for operators that are specific to one asset class, or are some of the syndications that you're passively involved in, are they kind of opportunistic syndications, meaning like they've got multiple different asset types within them? Can you give us a better picture of what that looks like for you?
Yeah, great question. So I definitely come across operators once in a while that have a fund, for example, where they're buying different types of assets. So they might buy industrial, retail, and something else, apartments, right? And some investors like that because they're getting diversified within the fund itself. But what I try to focus on personally, just for my own comfort level, is I like to, my favorite is investing with an operator who only focuses on one asset class when that's possible. And then I think it's okay if they focus on two as well, or maybe they focus on one at one point and shift it and they have some experience in the second. But where I get really worried is if somebody's done three or more or is focused on three or more, that to me is kind of that should be a kind of a black and white cutoff, so to speak. And that's just my concern about, when you're an operator, and you know this because you're an operator, you've got to be really focused and understand NFS really well. And Frank, and actually your focus on mobile home park specifically, you really have to know your stuff, right? You got to understand the utilities and infrastructure you're dealing with when you're buying something. Mm-hmm. You got to understand the sewage, because I mean, all these things can really come to bite you in the rear if you don't do your due diligence properly up front. You need someone. I need to be making a bet on a person who understands this really, really well. And so my preference is to invest with an operator who only focuses on one asset class if that's possible, or maybe two, because that tells me, especially if they've done a lot of deals, that they've become a true expert in that asset class.
Yeah. No, you make a good point there. I'm a person, and I've owned hundreds of single family homes. I've owned hundreds of apartment doors, and now it just happens to be that for the last 4 or 5 years we've been focused on mobile home parks. But I know my personality type, and I know that I can only be really good at one thing at a time. I can be good at other things, but I can't be an expert at more than one thing. And so like that's where we focus all of our attention. It's always actually astounding me that there are some people out there that do it pretty well. They can handle multiple different asset types pretty well. And they seemingly run a profitable business and they are very successful, but it's just, every single individual asset type is a different business model. I mean, mobile home parks is a completely different business model than apartments. Apartments are a completely different business model than a self-storage facility. They're all very diverse in nature. And so it's very challenging, not only just to run one like an expert, but figure out how to run multiple, two or three or four different asset types. So
yeah, and I want to just clarify one thing I said, so just to be clear. I wasn't saying that somebody, just to be clear, I wasn't trying to say that somebody couldn't have done previous asset class, like other asset classes in the past. In fact, there are definitely some benefits, and it's very common, for example, that I'll meet some people who started in single family, graduated to multifamily, for example. Mm-hmm. And then when they get into multifamily, the experience they've got in single family, because some of it's translatable, some of it isn't, is actually a big benefit. It's a big plus.
Sure.
So I'm not looking for an operator who is only focused on one asset class their entire life. It's more the idea of kind of like what you're doing, where you focus on mobile home parks for the past 5 years. I want someone who's focused on a specific asset class for at least a few years now and got to know it well,
yep.
As opposed to in the fund scenario you mentioned where they're actually doing three different asset classes at the same time. The challenge for me is when they're doing it at the same time that it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a ton of sense. So that brings me to my next question is, you yourself being the passive investor and being that you actually manage, you manage other investors that are actively involved in these deals passively, you have to become somewhat of an expert. I mean, at least to run your own due diligence on the actual sponsors themselves, their business model. I mean, you have to understand it, maybe not as much as they do, being that they're active and they're running the show, but you still have to get very comfortable with that asset class. So how does someone like yourself, from a passive standpoint, become an expert in all these different asset types?
Yeah, great question. So it's a combination of a few different things. First of all, I would call it opportunity exposure. A lot of newer investors that I talk to ask me, how can I learn how to, analyze the syndication in apartments? And let's say they've never invested in an apartment opportunity before, right? And they're not a real estate investor. They're brand new. The challenge is that there isn't a book that I can necessarily refer them to for a specific asset class typically. So what I tell them is, look, the way I learned is through opportunity exposure. I end up creating a ton of opportunities in a specific asset class, and you learn a lot. You learn a lot about what people look for, how people run comps, expense ratios, other things that you wouldn't necessarily know without reading a whole bunch of and looking at a whole bunch of competitive syndications within the exact same asset class. So that's definitely one important way. Another way is to talk to enough operators. So interviewing operators on specific deals and doing a lot of listening. right, and learning. And actually, a lot of property in-person walkthroughs, you can learn a ton, and I'm sure you understand this. If you were to walk onto a mobile home park site with somebody, you being an expert in mobile home parks, you probably point out 20 different things that they would never know to even look for. Mm-hmm. But boy, that would be an amazing lesson for somebody within just 20 minutes, for example, right? So I've done a lot of walkthroughs of properties with operators and learned a lot from those. In some cases, I've actually attended courses on those specific asset classes. I've done that in mobile home parks, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I end up with all this combined, and all this takes time, right? It's not like you can just open a book, read it, and you're done with it in 3 days. This all takes a lot of time of talking to different people, getting different perspectives, and learning a lot about the business. And one great example of self-storage, okay? So with self-storage, there's actually two different components to revenue that are very important. And I think a lot of people, let's say, invest in a typical apartment or other type of asset class, won't really realize what's going in. But one issue with self-storage is they do concessions and promotions. The typical thing of, like, you know, your first month is free. And that's a marketing tactic. And it's under a concession, promotions, expense line, or counter, it's basically a contra income type or contra revenue type of line. And when you're analyzing a self-storage deal, it's not just good enough to understand the revenue increase assumptions for that asset class. You have to understand the concession and promotions too, because there's almost like a multiplier effect. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't know that unless you started talking to a bunch of self-storage operators, and because they're going to start talking to you about, or they should explain to you how they handle concessions and promotions. And you'll actually see it on their expenses. So just if you took five different self-storage syndications and looked at their pro forma and looked at their individual expense lines, theoretically they should all have that concessions promotions line. Now the cool thing is that if you have five of them in front of you and one of them doesn't have it, you'll actually know that that's odd, because why are they not including it, right? Mm-hmm. So that already gives you a question mark, should you invest with that operator? Then you put that one aside. But the other four, you can literally say to them, what is this, how do you handle it? And then in three or four calls, you probably learn almost as much as you need to know about how that works to look out for it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these conversations end up yielding a lot of things, but opportunity exposure is really, really critical. I also want to say that, you know, to your point earlier, I think one of the biggest and most important things that people need to do if they're going to be passive investors is to be able to evaluate who they're making the bet on. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is particularly applicable for, like, startups, when somebody brings you this new idea of a new business they're launching, non-real estate related. But a lot of people tend to get very caught up in, this is a fantastic idea, I want to invest in the idea, like, mm-hmm. someone has the best idea in the world. The problem is that I think people don't put as much emphasis on the execution, meaning that you can have the best idea for a business, but if you've got the wrong person running it, it's not going to be successful. And I would say the same thing in real estate. You know, I like using the example, I live in Los Angeles, right? And so I like using the example of, like, I can take a look at, invest in the best building on Rodeo Drive in the center of Beverly Hills that's 100% occupied today, and it's like an amazing asset. But if somebody runs it to the ground and it becomes vacant, we're going to end up handing the keys back to the bank. And it didn't matter that it was in the best location ever. Mm-hmm. So I think that the number one thing people need to consider when they're looking at a syndication and making a bet on somebody else, who are they making a bet on? And being able to evaluate that person is really the most important thing that you can do when you're looking at syndications. The asset, to me, is very important, but it's in second place.
No, that's a great point. I mean, an idea is nothing without an execution. Everyone and everybody has got great ideas. Your grandmother has great ideas. Our brother has great ideas. Sister, I mean, everyone that you run into has great ideas, but execution is something completely different. Without the proper execution, it doesn't work. You know, the business doesn't work. So talk to me a little bit, Jeremy, about number one, I guess there's kind of two different questions here. Number one, how do we seek out these potential sponsors? Because I feel like the world of syndications, in terms of the opportunities that exist out there, there's no, like, one, you know, collective database where we can go to a website and say, okay, well, here's all the private offerings that are out there. I mean, it doesn't work that way. A lot of it's networking. So, but are there any other ways how we can seek these out? People that are listening in that have an interest in, you know, doing what you're doing, even if it's on a very small scale, getting involved in their first syndication, how do they seek these out? But then the second thing is how do we qualify the sponsors?
Yeah, so seeking them out, that is very tricky. And it's actually become a little easier now with the advent of crowdfunding. You know, when I first started, every single deal was only allowed to be privately marketed. And so that meant that I had to go to a lot of real estate networking meetings in LA. And frankly, to be honest with you, I went to a lot of seminars where they'd be pitching books, tapes, and whatever. And I'd sit in the back, wait for 2 hours, and then I'd network at the end with investors who were there to try to find opportunities. And so networking is a huge way to find opportunities. It's time intensive, but it definitely pays off over time. And it's really the strategy that I use. The other thing you can do if you're an accredited investor, you can log on to a lot of different crowdfunding sites, including Realty Mogul, who I'm an advisor for, and there's some other great ones too. And you can immediately get access to at least several opportunities per crowdfunding platform. So, for example, if you want to learn about multifamily, right, just like we're talking about, what I would recommend you do if you're a credit investor is go log on, sign up for the top 5 or 10 crowdfunding sites in the U.S. You'll probably find somewhere between 2 and 7 multifamily deals per site. And so the next thing you know, you literally have access within an hour to somewhere in the 15 to 30 range of number of multifamily opportunities you can literally print out and have side by side and start learning from right away. Mm-hmm. That's not something I was able to do way back when. So that's a great benefit to being, to be able to invest these days. So those are really the two primary ways to find opportunities. You could potentially try to find some investor groups. Like I have a private investor group. And those are also great sources because in the end of the day, if I think about every opportunity I've ever invested in, I've always found it through some type of networking because it's private. So it was either I met a sponsor directly at a private networking event or I got referred to a sponsor by somebody, or I met an investor at a networking event who sent me a deal that they were looking at. So it's all about networking to be able to find these types of opportunities or the crowdfunding platform.
Mm-hmm. Now go ahead.
I know, that's okay. You can ask me this question. I was going to go on to the next topic you mentioned about vetting them, but go ahead the operator.
Yeah, let me expand on that a little bit. The one thing we didn't really touch on in the beginning, it's probably a good time to bring it up now, is regarding accredited versus non-accredited. And I know that you had mentioned there's multiple different crowdfunding sites out there. Can you speak a little bit more to, because there's a good chance that we have both accredited and non-accredited investors listening to this show. And so if there's non-accredited investors out there, meaning they've got less than $1 million net worth, not including their primary residence or the income qualifications to meet the accredited investor status, are there opportunities out there for the non-accredited people of the world? I mean, to get involved in a passive role in investments?
Yeah, so a lot of people would be surprised to find out that most of the investments that I participate in, which are not on the crowdfunding platforms, but directly with the operator, typically actually accept accredited and non-accredited. I would say that it's probably at least 80% of them that I see. Hmm. And so there are definitely a lot of those out there. The tricky part for non-accredited investors is that they're not going to allow to get access to the crowdfunding sites because of the way that the crowdfunding wallets work. They have to be accredited investors. And so long story short is all the non-accredited investors are going to have to pretty much network to find these types of opportunities. They're always going to be privately marketed, at least. That's not true. There are some exceptions. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there's certain type of structure, legal structure somebody can use if they're raising less than $1 million, where they can actually solicit non-accredited investors with a certain type of private placement memorandum, but it's very rare. So the vast majority of them are all privately marketed, and non-accredited investors just have to do networking to find the opportunity.
Yep, yep. And I forget which one that is. Is that the A-plus regulation? I can't recall which
No. There's a couple now, but those are crowdfunding. Non-crowdfunding structure, there's something called a Reg D 504. Most of the PPMs or private placement rounds that people fear are 506 regulations. Mm-hmm. This is Regulation 504 that actually allows for public marketing for under $1 million fundraise.
Okay.
And I hope I'm not confusing it because I believe it's for accredited and non-accredited. But anyway, it's a 504.
Okay. Got it. Well, that sounds good. So let's, I guess the second part of the question, I interrupted you, so I'm sorry to digress there, but the second part of the question was, how do we vet sponsors? I mean, so we find these opportunities, we go out with network, maybe we go into a crowdfunding site, but either way, we found an opportunity or opportunities, but how do we vet the sponsors now that we found something?
Yeah, so just to differentiate, so when you're looking at a crowdfunding site, very often what's happening is that the crowdfunding platform is actually pulling you into their own LLC. So when you're trying to vet an operator through a crowdfunding site, and by the way, I've never invested in an opportunity with a crowdfunding site, so I can't speak from actual experience, but my understanding is that you're going to get in touch with a crowdfunding site who will discuss the deal with you and not necessarily the operator directly. Mm-hmm. And so there are some exceptions, but let's just take that as standard. So when you're vetting the operator for a crowdfunding deal, you're really more vetting how the crowdfunding platform vetted the deal themselves. You can ask them all the questions, but you're not talking directly to the operator. In the event you find a deal directly with an operator, then what you're going to want to do is, assuming you've actually has some opportunity exposure and understands some of the basics of what you're looking for, be it understanding what a typical rent increase assumption is that's fair, a typical expense increase assumption each year that's fair for inflation, for example, and all these other things. Vetting an operator is tricky, and it's essentially what you're trying to do in the end of the day is determine if the person you're dealing with has basically under-promised, been very conservative with their assumptions, their projections, and how they presented things to investors, so that they're trying to under-promise, over-deliver, and create long-term relationships with investors, or if they're trying to over-promise, make the numbers look really good and very sexy so that they'll attract investors, but will likely underperform because they've been unrealistic in some of their assumptions, but they don't quite care as much about the long-term relationship. They're just trying to make the deal look good so they can find their investors today. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the two categories of operators you're dealing with. And if you're like me, you're trying to find the guys that are under-promising, being conservative, and trying to build the long-term relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And so one way you could do that is read the overview. And you're kind of trying to read between the lines in terms of how they phrase things. So, for example, if you read the overview and anything ever says is a guaranteed return of X, you know, to me the word guarantee is the first sign somebody's being very aggressive, and I would put it in the garbage because there is no guarantee legally of you getting your money back from any of these ever. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's number one. Number two is if somebody if you read the sentence, for example, while we believe that the occupancy rate will be higher in year two, we have assume that it's going to be 20% or, you know, X percent, you know, you're starting to get a sense, okay, these guys are trying to be conservative. So reading the exact words and actually getting a feel and reading between the lines of exactly how they phrase things even, it started to give you an idea, along with piecing together how their assumptions are put together, the actual numbers, and determining if you think those are conservative assumptions or not. If it looks like the phrasing's conservative and the numbers are conservative, then what you want to do is actually have a call with them, at least one call, have a whole bunch of questions set up for them. And to be honest with you, sometimes the answers to those questions aren't as important as the wording that you hear back from them, right? So even though something looked conservative in the way it was phrased on paper and in the pro forma, if you get on the phone and someone's telling you there's a guaranteed return, or, we know this market really well, we're definitely going to get this rent increase, you know, versus the phrasing of, well, to be honest, we think we can do better. We really think we can do better based on our experience in this market, but we put it, the number we use is that lower expectation for investors. That's the kind of wording that I want to hear, right, as an investor. Mm-hmm. Because that way you know that the numbers that have been put on, that are put forth in front of you, have a very good chance of being met and possibly exceeded, which is great, and that you're looking at more realistic numbers. So it's kind of a combination of reading between the lines in terms of how the offering was written, taking of the performance assumptions and your conversation with the operators and just being very cognizant of how they're speaking to you, the words they're using. And, you know, I wanted to stress the fact that I go into every opportunity assuming there's something wrong with it, because the reality is that as an investor, you're going to turn down most opportunities. So you almost got to have to go with the attitude of, like, where is the problem with this, right? You're trying to find the problem, almost like you're trying to solve a murder case. Mm-hmm. And if you end up going down the list and there ends up not being a problem, you're surprised, pleasantly surprised, and you end up investing in it.
Yeah, that's great. The way I would approach it. No, that's great advice. We look at every deal that way. We go, like, tell me why we shouldn't be buying this deal. It looks so good. Everything looks like it should. I'm happy with the numbers, but give me the red flag. I need to see. There's got to be something here. And maybe it's not enough of a reason for us not to move forward, but there's got to be something negative. Let me uncover the negatives. And so we always really go into deals looking for those things as well, because there's never going to be the 100% perfect opportunity, right? You're probably always going to find something that, you know, that you maybe not dislike. It's not going to change your mind about whether or not you want to invest in the deal. But, you know, if everything looks perfect, like a bed of roses, and, you know, seems too good to be true, then it probably is, right? I mean, at least that's my personal experience, at least as an investor and being an active investor.
Yeah, and you know, I 100% agree with you, and I would say on the passive side that basically I end up with a bunch of what I call yellow and red flags. And if I have typically a red flag will make me go out of the deal right away, because a red to me is like a showstopper. And then you have a bunch of yellow flags. To your point, you're not going to never have zero yellow flags. I think if you actually found zero yellow flags, you may have not looked hard enough, honestly. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say never, because never is probably a strong word, but it'd be highly unusual to have zero yellow flags. The purpose of the yellow flag is that you caught them and that you want to go talk to the operator, communicate with them, and try to understand whether they're truly a yellow, like whether they're a red flag or whether they're actually no flag.
Yeah.
Meaning that you want to clarify it for them, understand them better, and make sure that you understand which category it should fall in. And that's the purpose of yellow flag, is stuff you want to try to clarify.
Fair enough. I need to add more colors to my flag classifications, because I guess in my mind, a red flag is like, I just need to stop and figure this out, or stop, like, let's back out the deal. So I use red flags for different, there's different definitions to my red flag theory. So, but maybe I just need to add different colors to my classifications.
There you go.
So, yeah, fair enough. Well, gosh, I just lost my train of thought there. I was going to ask you something. Oh, there was another question I really wanted to ask you, Jeremy, about being involved in these opportunities. Is, you know, everyone's got a different like time frame and horizon of how long they want their money to be involved in something. You know, a lot of people I've dealt with in the past with our investments, I kind of go into it telling them like, we're really long term investors. Like, we, you know, anticipate, you know, 7 to 10 year holds. I mean, just because what we buy, we enjoy holding it for a long time, especially if it's fairly really performing for us. And we're in an asset class, as you know, mobile home parks pretty well. They're not building them anymore, and so there's only so many in this country, right? And so it's an opportunity that if you can cherry pick some really good ones and good markets, I'm very hard pressed to have reasons of why we would ever want to exit out of it, at least not anytime in like the next 3 to 5 years. That they wouldn't be that kind of play for us. And so talk to me about, you know, from your perspective, how you invest in terms of what are your time frames? How long do you look to keep your money tied up? And the same goes with like a lot of the investors you work with. Like, what's the typical time horizon that they look for?
Yeah, great question. Everyone's different. And I'm going to tell you that the way that I work personally is that I actually change my strategy depending where we are in the cycle. And I'll explain that in a minute, but because real estate is cyclical, right? It goes up and it goes down. Mm-hmm. And so it operates in cycles. But I do want to say the first important thing to say is that whenever you're investing in a passive opportunity, regardless of what the timeline is originally expected to be, that can change. Meaning that I would be very careful if somebody says, okay, this opportunity is going to operate for exactly 5 years, and they're forced to give you your money back within 5 years, because typically they're going to want to have the flexibility to run a little longer if it's, you know, imagine if 5 years was 2008 or 2009 and they wanted more flexibility to be able to wait until there was more financing so they can sell it at the right time, you know, so somebody can buy it more easily. Mm-hmm. And for other reasons. And so, you should go in with the expectation that if you're investing in a 10-year, let's say the operator says the opportunity is expected to last 10 years, understand that could be 2 years, 3 years, 7 years, 10 years, and possibly even 12 years, okay? But the idea that the mindset of the person who's buying it on everyone's behalf and operating it is a 10-year mindset, but mm-hmm. it's subject to change. That's a very important point. And actually, just a live situation for you, I invested in three self-storage opportunities. One of them was 2013, two of them were 2015, and we're in the middle of selling all three of them. Two of them are 2 years old, one of them is 4 years old. They were all 10-year opportunities. Mm. But, you know, timing's right, buyer's right. They've done a lot of value out in the last couple of years. And even though we were all expecting 10 years, now is a really great time to sell. So as an investor, I'm going to vote for the sale, yes for the sale, for example. And mm-hmm. we all expected that to be 10 years. So I just want to make clear to everyone who's listening that these types of things can change, but that the general ideas are giving you kind of a directional idea of how long it's going to go for in the business plan.
Yeah.
So having got through that, I tend to change my focus during the cycle. So let's back up to 2009, okay? 2009, 2010. That's when the cycle started, right? The last cycle. Mm-hmm. So back then, I was willing to do a one-year deal, a six-month deal, a two-year deal, a three-year deal, because I personally believed that the cycle we were in was going to go on for at least 5 years, if not longer, if you look historically at previous cycles. So because I thought we were in the clear, I was happy to do even short-term hard money lending, et cetera. As of about 2013, based on how the market conditions were going and how pricing changed, that's personally when I stopped actually investing in shorter-term deals, and I went to only long-term deals because I thought there was a possibility of recession within the next 5 years, and I honestly thought it was going to be 2017 or 18. And I'm not saying this now because it's 2017, but I've told this to people before. So, you know, in fact, that's what I told people in 2008 and 2009. I thought it'd be 10 years from now was the next one. And so what I did was I switched in 2013 going into longer-term deals for two reasons. One is because with financing, I was only considering deals that had 10-year loans associated with them in case there was interest rate volatility, and in case we had a downturn so people couldn't get loans, for example. We wanted to be locked in for the longer term to be safe about it. So that's number one. And number two is that I typically invest in 5 or 10-year deals. Those are my favorite. I like to have my money locked well for the for the cash flow, because I'm a very, you know, low-risk cash flow investor. And so if I'm going to spend the time trying to find an opportunity, I'd rather be in it for 5 or 10 years where it's kind of producing a somewhat predictable cash flow versus a year. And so with that strategy in mind, you know, 2013, I was worried about a recession coming up within a few years. So I started only doing 10-year deals and looking at deals that had business plans that had 10 years. And not only those two things, but also asset classes that I thought would do really well in the downturn, economic downturn. So the three focuses I had since 2013 primarily, I've done other things too, was mobile home parks. They do well in downturn. Self-storage does really well in downturn. And then retail strip centers that have anchor tenants that will do well in the downturn. For example, large grocery anchor chain or a large pharmacy chain like CVS or Walgreens. People are still going to go use those retailers in a downturn. And so I change how I invest throughout the cycle. So right now, I'll only consider 10-year deals. And then once the cycle changes, and let's say we have another downturn, whenever that is, then I'll start looking at shorter-term deals again. And in fact, all my hard money, which is short-term loan flips for single-family homes, for example, those are all winding down in the last year or two just because of the fact that I didn't want to have to worry about when the downturn was going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't just take on one strategy. My favorite is being in a 10-year deal for the cash flow, but I change how I invest. I actually change even the asset classes I focus on depending on where we are in the cycle.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I would never have guessed that anchored retail, fares really well in downturns. I never really looked at it historically in terms of how they fared, at least anchored specific, like grocery anchored type strip centers. I've never realized that they've done really well in downturns. So that's good to know. Self-storage, I'm assuming self-storage do really well because if people are, downsizing or getting foreclosed on, they've got to put their stuff somewhere, right? Is that kind of the idea behind that, of why they thrive in downturns?
Exactly. Yes. People tend to, like, let's say that they, a foreclosure of a home, they move into an apartment, they'll have to actually store their stuff,
mm-hmm.
Which they may eventually move to home again in a few years, but for now they need to store their stuff. People tend to sometimes end up having more roommates. And when that roommate situation comes up, there's more stuff that has to be stored in a third party area. And so there's a lot of different reasons why storage did particularly well during the 2008-2009 downturn for those types of reasons.
And in worst case, I guess if they need it, they can go live in the storage facility.
Yeah, well, that is what, what's funny is that I believe is illegal in a lot of different areas.
I know.
No, but what's funny is that there are people that do that clearly because it's a pretty cheap way to live, and I hear stories about it, people doing that, and what they'll do is they'll kind of come in after dark, leave before it gets light, when no one knows they're actually living in it. But as an operator, you're supposed to look out for that and deal with it. But yeah, it does actually happen.
Oh my gosh. I think you'd just be better off getting a really, nice tent from Walmart, and you might be better off than trying to sneak in and out of a self-storage facility in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I guess you can get the climate-controlled units, though, so you get air conditioning in some of them, which you wouldn't have in a tent. So I might see the benefit of sleeping in a self-storage instead of a tent.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, so... we're kind of rounding out the end of the show here. We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned how you kind of adapt, you duck and weave when the times are changing, and you're kind of not necessarily forecasting, but historically, based on historical trends, like you think at some point in the coming years we'll probably go into some type of correction of some sort. So what are you seeing? I mean, so we talked about the assets. You've kind of changed your focus to particular assets based on the timing of where you think we're at in the cycle. But are there particular markets as well that you kind of either steer clear of at this point in time or that are more attracted to because of where we're at in the cycle?
Yeah, great question. First of all, the way that I invest always is I always look for markets that have higher cash flow. So the markets that tend to have more price volatility, like, for example, Santa Monica in a home, they're very highly valued. And so they'll go up and go down a lot during recessions and during upswings. And so I look for more stable markets where we don't necessarily get as much appreciation, but the cash flows are higher because people aren't willing to pay more for that asset than they are, for example, in Santa Monica. And so number one is I'm always looking kind of what they call a B-class market, which you'll get a little bit more cash flow. And it typically means I'm investing outside of California to avoid the higher pricing. Number two is I tend to avoid some weather challenges. So, for example, hurricanes. Hurricanes are okay for some asset classes and not potentially for some others. And so one asset class that works really well in hurricanes, just as an example, is self-storage if it's kind of some of the newer vintage that can withstand higher winds. And so, a lot of those facilities don't have windows. And so when you come in, even if you have a major hurricane, you could have some exterior damage. And in a lot of these facilities, the tenants are forced to have insurance on their own item for flooding. Mm-hmm. And so I'm comfortable, let's say, investing in a self-storage facility in Florida, knowing there may be hurricanes, because they tend to do really well. And in fact, ironically, if there's a really bad hurricane, then and people have a house damage, they might actually have more demand for self-storage facilities right thereafter to move their stuff into it while their house is being repaired or whatnot. So, so in some ways, it's actually a good asset class to have in that type of climate. Whereas an example of maybe what you may want to be more careful about a hurricane with the type of structure that is more susceptible to a hurricane. So I'm comfortable investing in self-storage in Florida, but maybe not some other asset classes there.
Yeah.
And then there's also economic factors, right? So one very important thing to look at is always what economies are growing. And a great example in the next 10 years, population projections for Florida and Texas, very high. So you obviously want to be more specific than just Florida or Texas. You want to look within those states as to where to go. But the point is, you know, there's going to be a lot of demand growth in those states. And there are some states that have been having a lot of challenges. I'm going to use the typical one everybody's familiar with. Like Detroit has had a lot of issues in the last 20 years. There's definitely been a resurgence there, but I'm just using an example over the past period. And so you're going to want to be very careful in areas that are either stagnant or facing a decline and kind of focus on more of the growth area. Mm-hmm. So there's no like one answer I have for you, like what's my favorite area right now, because I like to be diversified across geographies. Mm-hmm. But there are certain things that I stay away from. So that's kind of a better answer that I can give you, is like, what do I stay away from as opposed to what I'm looking for?
No, that's great advice. So with regards to like Detroit, I mean, it has seen a resurgence, and I don't follow Detroit, so I don't know from a micro level what that really means. I don't own any investments there, and I've never really spent any time looking at any potential opportunities there. But do you think it's almost near the verge of where you might consider going into a market like that, you know, when it's on a resurgence?
Yeah, good question. I am not following Detroit right now because the lack of stability there in general, because I'm really low risk. So to me, I'm not going to invest in it right when it starts to pick up. I'll invest in it when it's more stabilized. But I'm not looking for that capital gain or that increase in value. I'm looking for that stability. So I can't give you a really fair answer on Detroit because I'm not following it that much. I know people that invest there, but I don't know well enough to give you a proper
answer. Okay, fair enough. Well, Jeremy, this has been an absolute blast. I know we're running out of time here, and so I'd like to enter on what I like to call the golden nugget segment of the show. This is where we're going to kind of wrap things up for the day. And what I'd like to ask of you is if you could leave our audience with just one final golden nugget of advice or wisdom that may inspire and motivate them as they progress in their real estate investing career, what would that one last golden nugget be?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, definitely be cognizant of real estate cycles. Now is a very, very expensive time to buy something, and it's a good time to sell in many cases. And so if you're going to consider investing in real estate today, you want to be very careful with the purchase price and look for very unique situations, because a lot of them don't make sense right now. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I just want to point out is, I know we talked about this a lot during the podcast, but you know, if you're going to invest passively, the number one consideration is who you're making the bet on. It's not the asset that you're investing in. The number one is who you're making the bet on. Number two is the asset you're investing in. And one thing we didn't talk about today, which is very critical, which most passive investors unfortunately do not do based on my experience and discussions with people, is background checks. Mm-hmm. Background checks have saved me from investing with people who have had issues in the past, who may have been criminals in the past. And unless you do them, you won't know who you're dealing with. And remember, if the number one thing you're focused on is who you're making a bet on, you're going to want to assess all aspects of it. And background check is one of the final steps I do before I decide if I want to invest in someone, so I don't pay the money up front and then thought I didn't like the deal.
Yep.
But it's a critical piece that a lot of passive investors don't think about.
Let's give me 1 minute, Jeremy, because I'd like to ask you one more question regarding the background check. What's a resource that the listeners could use if they're looking at a passive investment, they want to do a background check on one of the sponsors? How do they do that?
Yeah, so I'm not as familiar with the kind of web version of background check companies that are more for consumers, but I use something called TLO, which is like TomLarryOffice.com, which is actually owned by TransUnion. Very thorough. It's actually, I know someone who's a police sergeant, and he tells me that's actually what they use as well. So it's very, very thorough. Another one you can use, which is owned by LexisNexis, is called Accurint, which is ACCURINT.com. The challenge with both of these websites is that they have to pre-qualify you, and they actually do an on-site inspection to make sure you have a locked drawer where you're going to print these. Very, very serious.
Yeah.
It's actually a crime to run a background check on, like, George Clooney if you don't need to. They'll actually flag it and come to your door because it's illegal. So they take it very seriously, and to get access to it, you have to go through a whole bunch of hurdles. But if you're willing to go through the hurdles, the information gets fantastic and can really save you. And what's really ironic is that if you're willing to go through the hurdles, background check cost me literally $11 to run on somebody. You would think it was like $200. But if you're not able to just jump through the hurdles or you don't want to apply for these, you can always look up a private investigator in your area. You get one that's licensed. I think they have to be licensed in most areas. What they'll do is they'll actually already have a membership to one of these sites. They'll run the check for you. The cool thing is they'll actually then scan it for you and see if they find anything and explain it to you. That's going to be, you know, $150, $200, but it's still worth it compared to whatever amount you're considering investing in you can lose.
Absolutely. No, that's great advice. Yeah, we're actually set up with TLO, not necessarily for background checks, for other reasons, but it's a little challenge to get set up with. It is. Yeah, in fact, I think one of the other criteria, you actually have to have a physical office. At least I think when we got set up, you did. You had to have a brick and mortar office and had been in business for at least 2 years with an LLC or, you know, some kind of corporate entity structure. And but yeah, it's information that is very sensitive. So I get why they actually make you jump through all the hoops, but it's definitely a very, very valuable resource to have have at your disposal. So whether you're doing background checks or even just researching properties, I mean, there's just so much power behind that tool. And I've never used the LexisNexis version, but I've heard that that's very comparable as well. So
yeah, they're very similar. They're both equally good. They're both fine. Doesn't matter which one someone uses. They're both really good.
Okay. Well, fantastic. Well, Jeremy, that's all we have for today, but I really appreciate you coming back on the show. And for those that are tuning in or listening that want to reach out to you, email address for you I have is jroll@rollinvestments.com. Is that the best way for them to reach you if they have a question or want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, email is by far best for me because I'm constantly scheduled on calls, so calling me is very hard to reach me. But the email is with jroll, so JROLL. @RollInvestments, which is ROLL Investments with an S, .com.
Okay. Well, fantastic, Jeremy. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really appreciate your time. And you take care, my friend. Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
Congratulations. Now you've got more of the best tricks of the trade in building massive amounts of passive income from real estate. For more amazing resources, visit realestateinvestingforcashflow.com. And we'll see you next Monday morning.